adults who used to be independent, one-third also still have children or grandchildren under the age of 18 living with them and take care of two or more people, usually parents, and the role lasts for an average of 5 years. Obviously, there is an overload of responsibilities, and she has written this book to guide people through the role and help people through the role of caregiver. The book is inspired by her journey as a caregiver for her husband, Clay Filker, the story of how they survived and even thrived over the last 17 years of his life are threaded throughout these pages, along with the stories of many other inventive caregivers and the helpful strategies that everybody has learned the hard way. And isn't it true? We learn these the hard way. Gail, of course, the author of a number of books, including Passages, which remained on the New York Times bestseller list for a number of years. She's a literary journalist, one of the original contributors to New York Magazine, a contributing editor to Vanity Fair since 1984. She won the Washington Journalism Review Award for Best Magazine Writer in America for her in-depth character portraits of President Bush's, Bill and Hillary Clinton, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich, former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, former Iraqi President Saddam Hussein, and Mikhail Gorbachev. She's written a number of other awards for distinguished journalism, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. I know this is an issue, and she cites somewhere in here the number of Americans who are in the role of caregiver. It is just a huge number of Americans. If you've been there or if you are there right now, you know that your health can suffer as a result of this role. There are a number of pressures. There are things that you have to learn about the medical community, and sometimes you just want to throw up your hands and say, I can't do it anymore. Well, welcome phone calls for Gail, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Gail Sheehy, a pleasure to have you with us. Hello, thank you.
Well, I'm lovely. It's lovely to be talking to you, Kathleen.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. And what a time you went through for so many years, Gail. I'm so glad you wrote the book because we need books like this right now.
Well, I was astonished. I thought, like most caregivers, that, you know, I was alone and kind of lost. And when I discovered that there are nearly 50 million Americans who are taking care of an adult who used to be independent, a family member of mom, dad, sister, brother, or spouse, as I did. And that's only, you know, 10 million fewer than parents who are taking care of children under 18.
Oh, my.
So, and then that our number of caregivers of adults will only grow as the boomers, you know, move into the Medicare generation. And it's a predictable crisis for Americans in midlife and later life today, family caregiving, unpaid family caregiving.
In your particular case, you say the average is about 5 years. For you, it was a long, long, long period of time with Clay, your husband.
Right. But, you know, what's increasingly common is my husband had cancer four different times, but each time he beat it, and it came back in a different way or different place. So there were long respites in between of, you know, 4 years, 6 years, when we felt really so blessed and excited, and we changed our lives. And one of the things that can happen with life-threatening illness is it's a wake-up call and a prod to, you know, look at your life and say, well, what could we do that would be more stimulating, more rewarding, a way of giving back? And, you know, maybe it means moving to another part of the country and starting again. But that's very, very helpful to the immune system. It gets all those, you know, anti-stress hormones cooking and helps to get you healthy.
I think at one point, and I couldn't believe you had the courage to do this, you and your husband went to Paris, and he was pretty sick at that point, couldn't eat food. And you said, oh, I want to go to Europe. I know you've wanted to take this trip. Let's do it. And he said, okay, and off you went.
Well, the big limitation there was he had a feeding tube. And a lot of people think that a feeding tube is the beginning of the end. Actually, my husband had a feeding tube for 10 years. But in the first 6 months, we thought, well, you know, we really can't go out to eat, and it wouldn't be fun for him to sit there while I have a nice meal. And so we were kind of shut-ins. And, you know, summer was approaching, and I said, I can't stand this anymore. I need to sit across from you in a candlelit restaurant, sipping a glass of wine and being romantic. So let's go to Paris. And, you know, my husband, being a journalist, was up for adventure. When we got off the plane after, you know, 15 hours, you know, door-to-door, I thought, oh, my goodness, he's so weak and tired. What was I thinking? But the next day I got a European version blender so I could mix up his brew in the hotel room. We did that for breakfast and lunch. And then I thought, well, we're not going to do this in the hotel room for dinner. So I found a small cafe with simple rotisserie chicken and vegetables and potatoes, and I asked to see the chef in the afternoon. And he came out, and I showed him the apparatus and what needed to be done, and told him that my husband, you know, would love to eat there, but that he really couldn't, you know, he had to have his food pureed. And he said, oh, madame, your husband drinks his chicken?
Aww.
No, not exactly. And I explained to him, and then he said, oh, quel dommage, you know, the idea that you couldn't taste his wonderful cuisine. But he was more than happy and gracious to do this. And that night he sent out two waiters with big silver trays and silver carafes on them with first and second course, all pureed perfectly. And they protected our view, and we sat there and had this most wonderful evening for about 3 hours. And Clay could smell my food, which was the way he stimulated his appetite and enjoyed it. And at the end of our evening, you know, a French couple came over to welcome us to Paris, which is, you know, not very usual for Americans in Paris. So we were very encouraged. And after that, we went to friends' houses. They came to our home. We went out. We went to restaurants frequently. And I would just make sure to see the manager or the chef in the afternoon and ask if they would make this extra effort. And they were always willing to do so.
Yeah. And at one point, and you have these kinds of moments, I'm sure. You do this 12-hour flight from New York to get to Paris, and you describe yourself, what the heck am I doing here? And
right.
He obviously was tired by that flight, but you got yourself going again. You got up and brushed yourself off and started all over again.
Right, and actually poured a café au lait into his feeding tube, which got him up and running, and his, you know, saying, let's go to the Louvre. You know, the whole idea, I think one very important thing is if something goes wrong, for instance, when I first got the call, I was in a beauty shop. We were going to a concert that night, and it was an oncologist I hadn't spoken to for 2 years when he had taken out a cyst on Clay's neck and told us that it was benign. So 2 years later, he calls me and says, it's not benign.
Hmm.
I said, who is this? And he said, I said, you told us 2 years ago, and he said, I know, the pathologist cut the old slides. It's cancer.
Oh, my.
So, you know, when you're hit with that kind of news, that kind of blow, as so many people are, but you're 2 years behind the eight ball, you can either spend your energy on, you know, blaming and, you know, suing and, you know, going over all of that, or you can just pick up from where you are and move ahead and take the, you know, accident in stride and work on, you know, creating new life.
Mm-hmm.
But we did, and I think that was turned out to be a good decision. But, when you know, we had to also learn, Kathleen, and this is something I want anybody who's in the caregiving life to know, don't take a passive role. Don't take the first doctor's recommendation. You know, when you are hit with the sudden caregiving call, you're going to see two or three or four different doctors and specialists, and they all have a slightly different approach, sometimes a radically different approach. And what I think is you have to find one that you really trust, who seems to be willing to partner with you, to collaborate with you, the patient and the caregiver, and ask him or her to be your medical quarterback. That is to help you come up with a care plan, and then assemble the care team, who's going to be on it, which of the other specialists, and maybe complementary medicine, and then help you call the plays.
Right. Tell me about this doctor you interviewed. He was a surgeon, but he was close to 80 years old, and you were understandably concerned that maybe he was too old to do a very delicate surgery on Clay.
Well, you know, we at first we liked him so much, and then we were having these second thoughts about an 80-year-old man with his hand on my husband's throat. So we asked to have a second consult with him. And as soon as we walked into the office, it was apparent that he knew why we were there. And without having to really ask the question except to say, you know, how many of these surgeries do you perform, Dr. Conley? And he held out his hands while he was talking and told us, you know, he did three of these surgeries a week, and they were 3 to 5 hours long. And he said, I'm very, very steady. And so without having to embarrass him, my husband was then able to express some of his fears and to say to this doctor, you know, I've really never expressed fears to another man, but you didn't make me feel small. And he said, I have fears too. What I want you to do is tell me on the morning of the operation, Dr. Conley, you're going to do a splendid operation. So now we were a team. And boy, when you're working that way with a physician, it makes all the difference.
There is so much to learn, and caregivers, tell us your story or others in the book. You have to learn so much about Medicare and Medicaid and the amount of time they'll give you in rehab programs. There's a whole medical world out there that you really have to navigate and have to learn a lot of complicated information that you just didn't know before.
Absolutely. You know, it's really, you know how you feel when you line up for registration at college and you have no idea what any of the courses
yes.
are that you're going to have to commit to?
Right.
Well, it's sort of like that, or even more. It's kind of like being dropped into a foreign country without a visa, and you really don't know how to get around. But so one of the things I suggest is, you know, examine the possibility of a geriatric care manager. That's a new profession that's been, you know, exploding in the last 10 years. These are mainly social workers, nurses, maybe geriatricians, who have been in the healthcare system for many years and really know how it works and keep up with the rules changes. And for them, for a geriatric care nurse to come and see your loved one and assess what his or her needs are, whether it's at the beginning of the process and you need to know, you know, what kind of rehab you may need after a surgery, or whether it's later into the process when the person is home and, you know, doesn't want to accept anybody coming in from the outside but really can't be home alone, and you, the caregiver, have a job to go to and you can't, you know, be there 24 hours a day. A geriatric care manager can sort through the thicket and help guide you to getting good home care, setting up what becomes a small business, monitoring it when you have to be away. You can give them, you know, access to your doctors so that they could be in communication with a doctor if you have to be away. And if you're living in another city, it becomes really
yes.
your eyes and ears on the spot.
Yes. And sometimes you have to be away. Your career, of course, suffered some during some of these time periods when he was sick. But you also, and I think caregivers let themselves get sick because they have too much to manage. And there were times when you needed to go cover the Clinton campaign for the presidency, right? In 2008,
right.
You had to do it.
Well, actually, it was my husband's doctor at that time who ordered me to go on the campaign, go get back to work. This was towards the very end of my husband's life in the last months. And Dr. Morrison said, you know, you have to be yourself. You're a writer. Go out and work. And he said it at my husband's bedside, and Clay endorsed it and said, yes, go. Just bring me back the news. as soon as I put my suitcase into the back of the taxi and said LaGuardia, this fog of kind of semi-depression lifted. And it was so energizing to be back being myself, because the big danger with caregiving long-term is that you lose yourself. You become so identified with the person you're taking care of, and you may slip into what I call a stage of playing God, where you think, and often it's true, that you're saving this person day by day from one disaster or mistake or another. And as long as things are going well and you're winning, you know, it's very ego-satisfying to think of how important you are.
Yes.
And caregivers are. I mean, you do have to be the advocate. It is a matter of survival. But when things go wrong, and that's inevitable, some treatment will backfire or an illness might come back. If you're God, it's your fault. And then the whole crush of guilt will come down on you. So you finally have to get to acceptance, and you may need to work with a professional to do this, that, you know, there is a God, if you believe in God, but you aren't it. And you're probably doing more than you have any idea. Just, you know, being present, just staying on top of it.
Yes, how true.
Yeah.
But you went through times, Gail, when you really weren't taking care of yourself. I think you got shingles at one point. You didn't even know you had them. You noticed this welt, spreading welt on your body, but you were so involved in caregiving that you're having heart palpitations, you were waking up in the middle of the night. You can lose yourself in this process.
Absolutely. And you know, I love you, Kathleen, because you read the book. That's so unusual and kind. So I did. I called one of my best friends, who's a gynecologist, and she said, "You've got to get in here to see me." And when she saw this welt spreading around my waist, and asked if I'd had chickenpox as a child, yes, and she said, "Well, you know, that virus can go dormant, and when you're under acute stress for a lengthy period of time, it can flare up. And this can be a life-threatening illness, too. You have to take care of yourself." And that was a wake-up call. And then I began to do the things that I now tell everybody else to do, starting from the beginning. Breathe. You know, that's the single best ally you have, and you can do it anywhere. It's best if you do it quietly while you're meditating. If you do it, you know, yoga is really a moving meditation.
Yes.
There's all kinds of meditative situations that you can, take advantage of. But breathing so that you continue to have the energy to move your blood around is really important. What I say is you have to take at least an hour a day to do something pleasurable for yourself. It can't be, you know, no fair calling the doctor about the prescription that didn't arrive. It has to be completely getting away, taking a yoga class, taking a wonderful walk, going to listen to music, going to the library to spend, you know, an hour and a half just reading where nobody can get to you, having coffee with a friend. You know, if you're a guy, working in the garage or, you know, fixing up your old car or whatever it is that where time just drifts by and you don't even know it. And that interrupts the hormonal cycle of hypervigilance and lets your body reset so that you don't continually pour out stress hormones until you don't have any left.
Yeah. I've been there, I know. Gail Sheehy is our guest this hour. If you are, well, we're all going to be caregivers at some point in our lives. If you're going through this right now, and I know many of you listening are, her book not only has a very personal description of her time taking care of her adored and very well-known husband, Clay Felker, who started a lot of magazines and nurtured so many very famous people in this profession. It talks about her caregiving over a 17-year period of time. At some times he was doing well, at other times not, and how she negotiated everything, loss of income in some ways, having to sell homes and dealing with the medical establishment. There are chance meetings, and these are always important in our lives, aren't they, with people who became helpers to her, and we'll hear those stories as well. Anna, we'd like to hear your stories. She, in putting together this book, traveled. She was, in 2009, AARP's Ambassador of Caregiving and traveled the country for months interviewing hundreds of caregivers and did a film on this, too, so there are families who are featured in her her book. The book is Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Gail now, and we start with Camille from Frankfort, Michigan. Hi, Camille.
Hello.
Hello.
Oh, there you are. I am experiencing absolutely everything that you're talking about. In fact, I'm already pretty burnt out. I had some medical issues of my own before any of the care for my mother became an issue, and she lives about 5.5 hours away. So not only am I had to make sure everything was in place all the time, but I constantly have to call behind all these people who don't call or show up at her house when they're supposed to.
Yes.
And it does not end. I have spent entire days with the phone in my ear. Mm-hmm. With insurance and all of it. I don't have to go through all that because you know already what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But what I want to say is that even though there are elder care organizations and all these things, everybody has to reinvent the wheel. It boggles my mind that you have to go through it all. Like as if nobody has ever gone through it before.
Isn't it true?
Yeah.
I know. You're absolutely right. Let me ask you this. Do you have any siblings or other family members, even living distant, who help, even if they're not doing so?
No, I have a sister in Georgia who's taking care of the finances, and she is absolutely not going to do more than she's already doing. And so it's fallen to me, and the question that I have for you regards the fact that my mother has a level of dementia where she shouldn't be living by herself anymore, but she understands enough to know that she doesn't want to leave her house. And so the only thing that is left to us is to have her declared incompetent, which would be just an incredible insult and stress mm-hmm. to her. And I just wish there were some other way.
Is she qualified for Medicaid?
Oh, well, yeah, she's not only that, but she's got long-term
Medicaid,
insurance.
In other words, the government insurance program for people who don't have more than $2,000 a month income?
Medicaid, not Medicare.
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. No, she's got Medicare, and she's got long-term health insurance.
She does. Okay. Well, then, you know, really, I think the only way is to find a geriatric care manager who can, you know, tag team with you to take some days where she stays on top of the people who are coming in to see your mom. Another possibility, depending on where she lives, is if there's a health sciences program at the local college, sometimes they will allow students to go in as volunteers and sit with and read to or play games with an elder who's at home, and it's one way to have, you know, eyes on the situation. An elder care manager, I know what you mean. I mean, trying to stay in touch and, you know, be the cop on the beat long distance is just a frantic and almost full-time occupation. Do you have a job?
I actually can't work anymore. I'm just trying to stay healthy myself.
Right. Well, the exchange might be that you get some work that would allow you to pay a geriatric care manager to be, you know, on top of it. And free you to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
That's one possibility. Somebody has to be monitoring the people who are going in and out to see your mom. You're lucky that you have at least, you know, one sibling who will take care of the finances, but perhaps she could take care of some of the calling with insurance company. If she's good at, you know, reading fine print and working, you know, calling up and, you know, arguing with bureaucrats, she might be willing to take on that part of it too, especially if you say, I am at the end of my rope. If when I burn out, there won't be anybody to take care of mom, and it'll all fall on you or nobody, and she'll have to go into a nursing home. So this is my cry for help.
Right. Thank you very much for the call. Who's going to take care of you, Gail?
Who's going to take care of me?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did get long-term care insurance because I see the handwriting on the wall. That's very important, but it's not full-time by any means. I have a daughter, but she has three young children. And like most people, I don't want to, you know, curb her life. So one of the things I'm learning about is the village movement.
Yes, that sounded great.
Yes, and this is spreading across the country. It started on Beacon Hill with people who lived in the same neighborhood, and they were getting it on in years, and they banded together to buy, you know, jointly shared services, to have a public health nurse visit all of them, you know, once a week, to pledge to take care of each other when through the good times and the bad, to share services like maintenance person, computer fixer, transportation if it was needed. And it grew into such a successful village that it's now reproduced in much less affluent parts of the city. And it's spread across the country. There are about 100 villages either working or in formation. It has to be people who are living in proximity, but the whole idea is to be able to age in place, stay in your own home, just like the mom in the previous caller, and have a community of caring that can buy services at a discount because of their numbers. They're all self-administered, but there's a core group that runs it and keeps everybody in touch. Social stimulation, they can travel together. And it really is almost a return to the commune spirit of the 60s in the same generation that enjoyed that period of time.
Let's go next to Fred from Green Bay. Hi, Fred.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I've been a fan of Gail Sheehy for some time. I remember reading your Passages books and the subsequent books to those as well.
Thank you.
I also wanted to say one thing I would encourage people to do. My wife died of cancer in September after a five-year, four-time survival battle with it. Is you need, as a caretaker, to support the person's requests and wishes, even when you don't necessarily agree with them. Even when you don't necessarily agree with those decisions.
Right.
For instance, I was now on the same page with her medical team, but she had complete faith in her medical team, so I bit my tongue and went with it, and it was the best way to go, and I have no regrets.
You're so right, Fred. It's a tough one, but it is the patient's life, and one of the most important things I learned from learning about palliative care, which comes before hospice and is meant to keep people out of the hospital when they're chronically ill, is to ask the patient, what are your goals for this period of your life? You have to ask it, you know, while they're under treatment, when they may be feeling pretty tired and weak, and ask it when after treatment, when they may feel a little depressed because now there's nothing active to do, and when they're in a long reprieve or when they're near the end of their life. And always, if you ask, you know, what are your goals for this time of life? What would you like? What's the reason that you get up in the morning and, you know, keep going? And there's, you know, going to be two or three or four reasons. And then the treatment needs to be shaped towards that, not what medicine, insists upon or
tries to talk you into or has to offer. And I, one man that I interviewed for an article in the AARP magazine out this month, his wife had was diagnosed with an incurable cancer and given 6 months to live. But, you know, when she seemed to be doing well, after 3 months they said, well, we can give you all this very heavy-duty chemo, but you'll have to come to the hospital almost every day. And she decided she didn't want to spend the time she had left that way. So she told her husband, let's take a trip across country. Let's buy, a camper. So he bought a camper, and they packed up their two big dogs and drove across country. And Carl, the husband, who had felt pretty powerless up until then, learned how to cook, and he cooked a nice meal and put up their awning, and they would sit there looking at the mountains and having their glass of wine every night. And then they came back through the Canadian Rockies, and at one point it was a beautiful sunrise in the mountains and on a lake, and his wife said, you know, the most wonderful thing about this vacation is I've forgotten I'm sick.
That's a good one to hear.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for the call. Why don't you spend some time, please, because I don't think we've done this, talking about your extraordinary husband. He was a real power force in the world of writing, mentored all kinds of very famous people.
Yes, Clay Felker, when I met him, remember, he had a huge voice. And I remember, you know, creeping down to his office. We were both at the Herald Tribune, wonderful newspaper in the 60s. And to try to pitch him a story, he was older than I. And all of a sudden I heard him saying, what do you mean you don't have my reservation? And later I heard Tom Wolfe, one of the writers he worked with for years and years. Tom Wolfe used to tell this story that he, you know, made up, that he was trying to get a biography of Clay, and he'd gone out to interview his sister in St. Louis, Missouri, in this little town called Webster Groves, which is where Clay was raised. And he wanted to know what, you know, impact Webster Groves had had on Clay. And his sister said, oh, none at all. His first words were, what do you mean you don't have my reservation? As if he were, you know, born with the DNA of a New Yorker.
Oh, that's funny.
he was always fixated on being an editor, and being an editor in the Big Apple is about as exciting as you can get. So he started New York Magazine. And we had 7 years of really an idyllic situation with, you know, Jimmy Breslin and Tom Wolfe, Gloria Steinem, Nick Pileggi, all kinds of writers. Women writers were then being given a great chance to write politics and very cheeky stuff that hadn't been possible before then. And it spread. It actually was the first city magazine, and its impact spread across the country, and city magazines popped up everywhere. And that was very important because urban life, you know, became very, very important counterpoint and reurbanization to the suburbanization that happened after riots in the 60s and crime. So it had an enormous impact. He went on from there to start other magazines. He worked for a long time at Adweek. He worked on the Daily News Afternoon Edition. He worked on Manhattan Inc. He was the editor of Manhattan Inc. business magazine. And during the big change that we made during his second cancer diagnosis was a doctor said, you know, this is indolent. It's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Any treatment I give you now isn't really going to prolong your lifespan, so I'm going to just tell you to go out and do something wonderful you wouldn't have dared before, the two of you together. And we sort of sat there open-mouthed. You're not going to give us medicine? But we walked out of there on a cloud. Pretty soon the cloud collapsed. They don't last very long. We had to actually act. We had to create a new normal, not just slide into a pale comparison of what we've been through. And Clay's colleagues, the people whose careers he had nurtured and in some cases fostered, created a brainstorming circle. And for the next year, you know, talk to different universities and colleges about the kind of program that Clay might want to teach, which would be hands-on actively creating magazines. Meanwhile, Clay and I were taking walks every weekend for him to think through, and anybody who is in the business of fighting life-threatening illness would find this useful. Try to think through what it is about the work that you've done that really was meaningful to you, stripped of title and position. And when Clay hit upon it, it was, I love identifying and shaping young talent.
Mm-hmm.
And that suggested a teaching role, but an active one. So that came together with his caregiving circle of colleagues, and the University of California, Berkeley, said they would be thrilled to have him start a magazine program. So we tore up our lives in New York that had been built in the publishing world for many years, moved to California, and took up this very different way of life, Northern California, able to, first of all, being in a faculty apartment with one bathroom that we fought over and brick and board bookcases and rented furniture. But we also found, you know, one wonderful running track overlooking San Francisco Bay where you felt like there was no horizons. You could do whatever your dreams cooked up and walk down to a cafe and sit outside in February and read the New York Times. And I think that would be appealing to anybody in Wisconsin or
yes.
Minnesota as well. And we felt young again and in love again. And it was a wonderful stimulation for his health, for my life. I was amazed the other day when somebody asked me, did you put your career on hold for those 17 years? And I said, oh, not at all. I couldn't have possibly, because I was going to have to go on. And I was going to have to pay for, you know, people to help me take care of Clay when it got more serious. And I had to prepare a path of comeback for myself for when I would lose him. That's part of the one of the biggest turnings that I talk about, turning points for the caregiver. So I actually wrote 5 books during those 17 years.
Oh, my.
So I actually, sometimes I had to put it on hold for a period of a few months while we were in active treatment. But then I would really go back to it, and I urge anybody who does have a job to try, if humanly possible, to keep it. And many employers now are actually instituting elder care assistance programs because they realize they have to keep the most valuable, you know, employees who are usually in middle life. And rather than having them cheat on the employer all the time, making calls to check up on the people who don't show up, give them flex time, make special arrangements for them so they can actually continue to be productive even if it is at a fewer hours a week.
Mm-hmm. And my advice, having been through this with my dad for a much shorter period of time a couple years ago, is to ask for time if you need it too, Gail, because I wound up really sick as a result of the constant stress and the emotional stress, and a guy who hadn't been to the doctor since World War II and he was 92 years old, and to navigate all of that with still a child at home and a full-time job, I wound up with a heart attack, to tell you the truth.
Oh, my.
Yeah, it was way too much. And what I should have done, and if people can do this, is to take a family leave. You know, to take, I need time here.
Absolutely.
And I think sometimes we just don't do that, and you have to do it.
You have to do it. I'm so glad you told that story, Kathleen, because actually the man who started the New York Caregiving Coalition, many, many groups that help, said, and he's a minister, he said, you know, he said, I've actually buried probably more caregivers than their recipients, because they just turn up on the doorstep of the hospital or the nursing home and have a heart attack.
Right.
Because we don't think we have the right to ask for help. That's why my main mantra in traveling around talking about passages in caregiving is you cannot do this alone. No one can.
Right, you can't.
You have to create a circle of care right from the beginning. And the circle, you know, at first it's about, you know, doctors and nurses and social workers and people who will, you know, buy into your way of thinking about this, which is to shape the treatment to the goals of the patient and advocate for you with other doctors and nurses and hospitals, you know. And the more time you spend cultivating a relationship with the doctors and nurses that are on your team, the more willing they will be to help you as you move down the road. But beyond that, creating a circle of care to me means, you know, getting friends and family, neighbors, people you work with, people who go to your gym or go to your church or your temple. Many people do want to help, but they don't know how.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't want to intrude. And oftentimes the caregiver and the patient are very private about what's going on because they either don't want to admit it or they don't want to be public with it. But boy, you need the help, and you need to get that permission from the person you're taking care of to ask other people to look in on, to stop by, to make the calls. Imagine if you could have, you know, a few friends who, you know, one day a week, they would pick up on the callbacks that you need to make so you could go to work.
Right.
That would be a great gift.
It sure would be. More phone calls. Gail Sheehy is our guest this hour. Her new book, and it's one of those books that you say, oh, I need to read a book like this before it happens to me, but you don't. And we all need to know this information. And those of you who are living this right now know that there was information that you wish you had because you had to navigate it by yourself. And it's very hard. It's emotional issues and financial issues and quality of life and all of that. It's as difficult as life can be, I think. And she navigates her experience with her extraordinary husband and also traveled the country speaking with a number of people who are caregivers. So it's advice on all of the areas. Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gail Sheehy is our guest, and her book is Passages in Caregiving. Let's go to Barbara from Hilbert. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The reason that I'm calling in is kind of to talk a little bit to the previous caller whose mother, she had stated, has a dementia diagnosis but doesn't want to leave her home. I actually own a company that manages and owns and operates several assisted livings in the state of Wisconsin. And there's a couple different avenues. First, I want to say to you this. When you call for assistance, and you're calling to an assisted living or skilled nursing facility or anything like that, trying to find options for your family, if they're not willing to help you find different avenues for financial avenues and, you know, how to get the doctor set up, how to arrange those types of things, it's the wrong place, okay? That's number one. The second thing I want to say is there are services available, and I'm not sure where this individual lives or where her mother lives, but there's guardianship services available for small fees where they can oversee some of the care aspects that really are time-consuming to family members. And the other thing that I would suggest to her is a lot of facilities, be they assisted living facilities or residential care apartment complexes, will offer what's called a respite stay. And I know in our particular company, what we do is for individuals, and no one wants to leave their home, let's face it. And when I get to be that age, you're going to have to take me kicking and screaming, okay?
Right.
So I understand her dilemma there. But one of the things that we do and try and promote is what's called a respite stay. And particularly with people that don't want to leave their homes and that are fearful of what it would be like if I lived in an assisted living or a residential care apartment complex. And the respite stay that we provide is we'll say, you know what, have mom come live with us for a month, no charge. Let her come see what it's like to live in a community where she knows that she's going to have balanced meals three times a day, where she knows that she doesn't have to worry about getting her laundry done, where she knows that she is going to be able to have her apartment clean, and she'll have someone there in case she does have a health issue. And let them come for a month. Generally, what we see when we offer that to an individual is the person comes in, and there's a level of safety that they find and camaraderie with their peers. And they end up, they don't want to go home because going home is now an unsafe place.
Gail, you want to respond?
Yes, I think that that's a wonderful idea. I hadn't heard of that before, but I often find that people who have been extremely resistant to assisted living, once they do get in, that safety factor is enormously. They may not even want to be taken out to go visit their, you know, children far away but would prefer to have a visit in the residence where they are. Respite care is also being provided now by some insurance companies, by some employers for the caregiver. That's as far as we've made progress in actually, you know, assisting the caregiver, but it's more and more widespread. And it pays to try to, if your company doesn't offer it, you know, go to the HR person and say, this is something you should offer. Because then you're going to keep employees who are going to be who are very valuable to you and keep them healthy.
Thanks, Barbara. Susan in Brookfield, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling to ask Ms. Sheehy about caregiving of people who have complex mental health problems such as anorexia nervosa or who cut, where a lot of the symptoms are surreptitious. Any suggestions for providing long-term support in a family and a community for people who, on the face of it, don't appear as if they want assistance? I understand a team approach, but does she have any comments on that particular population?
Well, the one thing that I learned in exploring, you know, taking care of people with cognitive decline is that those diseases largely miss the parts of the brain that are devoted to emotions and creativity. And the best way, and an increasingly promising way, to reach people even in mid- or late-stage Alzheimer's is through art or music, things that are nonverbal, not task-oriented, but actually go right to the direct creative part of the brain, and often will awaken memories that you couldn't burrow through in some task or verbal way. There are groups now that take Alzheimer's patients to art shows where they very directly relate to the paintings and emotionally become very active. It's difficult to find people who are aware enough to take care of somebody who has a complex of mental health problems. So the only other thing I can mention is for those who qualify for Medicaid, that is the, you know, limited income government provision for long-term care, there's a Medicaid waiver program called PACE, P-A-C-E, which has been wonderful for many people, where they actually will send an aide to the house to dress and transport your person to a central senior place, center, and they can see their doctors will see them there. They'll be there for most of the day. They'll have a lot of social stimulation, a good meal, be taken home. And that might be 2 days a week or 3 days a week. And it can, you know, the social stimulation of being with other people is one of the great health benefits rather than being home alone.
Thank you very much, Susan. We have some emails, but I'd like for you to answer these. How can you offer help with somebody who would appear not to? Tell it through. We have about a minute left. The story of Richard, who appears in your life and does some wondrous things, even though you resisted his offer of help initially.
Well, I was at the point where I had to sell my home in the country because I couldn't bring Clay out there anymore. He wasn't well enough, and it was an overwhelming expense. I had several gardens and so on. But I put it on the market and nothing happened because it was in some disrepair. So one day I was in a coffee shop and a man tripped me, it turned out deliberately, came over and started telling me some very bad jokes, and I just ignored him. But he did say that he was a widow and had been very devotedly caregiving for his wife for the last 2 years of her life, and that he was a builder. So he asked me, you know, if you're going to try to sell your house, shall I come over and look and see what we could do with it? So I kind of brushed him off, but I ran into him again a few weeks later, had still no nibbles on the house. He came over, and he said, well, there's a whole quarter acre here that's all, you know, tangled up with little sprouts and brambles, and we could clear that all, and you'd get a much better view, and would add substantially to the price of your house. So the next thing morning, I look out the window and I hear this big, grinding noise, and he's got a chains around a huge tree stump, and he's pulling it out with a winch. So I could see he was serious.
Yeah, he was so...
He'd clear all that land together, and then he would come every morning after that and take me out to go to a beach, to get in a canoe, to watch the sunrise, drink coffee,
mm-hmm.
and just be in another place.
And on that note, we're out of time. Gail, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And for the book. Yeah, thanks for the book. It's well worthwhile. The book is Passages in Caregiving. And I asked her to tell that story in response to some of the emails. How can I help? Sometimes it's just you show up, right? Chrissy Peace, producer of this program and on-air producer, thank you.